Welcome back, everyone, to the X-Cast. As ever, the truth is in here. I'm your host today, Carl Sweeney, still deputising for Tony Black. And today we are carrying on with our coverage of the second episode of the season, This, written and directed by none other than Glenn Morgan, one of my favourite writers who's ever worked on the X-Files. With me today is Clara Cook. Hi, Clara.
Hi, Carl. It's nice to talk to you again.
It really is. And today we're talking about none other than everyone's favourite lone gunman, or he's in the top three, definitely, Langley, and The Simulation. And we're going to talk about Erica Price too, Barbara Hershey's character. So I guess to kick us off, Clara, I mean, I'm not sure how abreast you've been with, like, spoilers or casting news or that kind of thing. So did you know Langley was coming back before this episode? Had you heard that?
I didn't, no. Not until I saw a trailer online and I saw him flashing on the screen. And actually, my first thought was, well, he's definitely dead, so this has to be some sort of artificial intelligence, or he has to be in some sort of virtual reality. And I have to say, I was delighted to be proved, like, sort of right, because I actually think it's a fantastic subject for the X-Files to tackle.
Yeah, I thought this was a very clever way to bring him back, because to be honest, I had a bit of worry about this. I mean, I heard a couple of things, like, probably 9 months ago or something, about season 11 that really got me worried for a little while there. Because I think a Fox executive came out and he said a couple of things. And he said that it's going to be 2 mythology episodes and 8 Monster of the Week episodes. And I just thought, you know, there's so much going on with this new mythology. That doesn't sound like the right balance to me. And then, like, this episode, episode 2, has come along. And I consider this basically a mythology episode. Or if it's not, it's a quasi-mythology episode. There's definitely elements of the mythology in there. So yeah, that's kind of been disproven already. And then the second thing this executive said was, are we, you know, the lone gunmen are going to be back. And I just had kind of nightmarish visions of them finding some way to undo the end of Jump the Shark. And it's not that I really like the end of Jump the Shark. I just felt like if you've killed the characters in such a manner, to bring them back would be a cheat, you know. I mean, I heard Tony in his interview with Dean Haglund the other day, he kind of wanted their death to be undone. But I would take the opposite view. I think you've got to live with your choices, you know, as a series. So yeah, I was delighted that, as it turned out, they did find a very intelligent way to bring him back for a purpose, didn't they?
Yeah, I think that I actually wouldn't say this is a Monster of the Week episode. I would say this is a mythology episode. There isn't really a monster. I mean, the monsters are the human beings who are coming to kill people, and the human beings who are putting people in a virtual reality where they become virtual slaves, or digital slaves. I think those are the people that are the monsters, but I don't think it's not a monster. There's no supernatural monster, and this isn't supernatural. There's nothing supernatural about it. I mean, I suppose maybe the technologically supernatural in the sense that we may not possess the technology to download somebody's brain or consciousness from the phone. So it's futuristic and science fictiony, but it's not really paranormal, because a lot of the technology that exists in the episode kind of already exists. The idea of virtual realities, the idea of surveillance of people, and also there's a lot of stuff in it about private security. Yeah. And what the private security agencies around the world and the actual the American government being sort of tampered with by outside forces. So that's none of that's paranormal or actually impossible.
No, well, it's one of those episodes that they used to do a lot in, like, the early days, where you'd be dealing with something that's, like, on the fringes of accepted science, I suppose, or weird science. So it kind of felt, I don't know, I thought the episode did a really good job of feeling, like, modern, but also kind of building on stuff they'd done before, you know, and it managed to look back to the past of the series, but also look forward and kind of appraise the world we live in today. So I thought it was quite a feat, actually. In terms of Langley, I think that first scene where we get the message from him, it reminded me a little bit of the episode Christmas Carol, where it begins with Scully receiving this phone message, apparently from her deceased sister, Melissa. You know, so I thought I'd just flag that up, because I haven't really seen that remarked on anywhere else. But I really liked, you know, those first stages where they're kind of unsure of what's going on. You know, they're kind of thinking about, you know, is there any chance he's not dead, you know? But then obviously, as it goes on, we meet this figure of his kind of partner, kind of like a girlfriend figure. We'd never seen her before, obviously, the Doctor. And we get a bit of an explanation of the simulation and so on. I mean, what did you think of this development? Because I've seen some people argue that, hey, we never heard about this woman in the past. You know, this has come out of nowhere. But where do you stand on that?
I don't have a problem with that, actually. I mean, Mulder didn't know everything about the private lives of all three of them. I mean, all three of the lone gunmen. It's quite possible that, I mean, that Frahiki had some sort of private past that he didn't tell Mulder about. I didn't have a problem with that so much. What I had a problem with, I think, was the idea that Langley, who was one of the, you know, three gunmen who were very paranoid about government surveillance and all that sort of thing, agreeing to download his consciousness or have his brain scanned, his brain activity scanned by a private company. I was thinking, would he really do that? You know, but then she says that he did it so he could be with her. And maybe he would do it so he could be with her. You know, maybe he would do it so that, I mean, maybe that's why he sort of went against his. And he was suspicious of the motives of the company, which is why he agreed to, I mean, I don't know. Well, what he suspected, if anything went wrong, they would flag for help, wouldn't they? If they suspected that something wasn't quite right and that they were being used for some nefarious means, that they would then flag for help. And so he was suspicious, I suppose. But at first I was like, what? You know, they had locks on their doors. They, like, checked their phones all the time. You know, they wrote these magazines and stuff about being spied on. Would he do this? But if he wanted to be with her, maybe he would. They seemed like an odd couple.
They do. They you do know, seem like an odd couple.
I wonder how they met. How they met, and I mean, how did that even work, really? But anyway, that's a fan fiction. Someone out there is writing it right now,
as we speak. Yeah, I didn't really have a problem with it either. You know, as a concept, because I think if you think back to those first couple of Lone Gunman episodes, I mean, they're obviously like ensemble pieces, but Byers really gets the meat of the storylines in those episodes, and his relationship with Suzanne Modesky. And then, of course, you know, they had their own spin-off, but it was kind of curtailed after just a short season. And then they're brought back to be kind of killed off in Jump the Shark. And then a lot of their other appearances in The X-Files are just kind of to impart some information or whatever. So I can sort of just about get on board with the fact that Langley has all this stuff going on that we never heard of. I think, yeah, like you said, they do look a bit of an odd... You wouldn't necessarily put them together, I suppose, is how I would put it. But I did think that actress gave a good little performance, you know, and she had a good couple of lines that hit home for me. Like, she says at one point, you know, they're watching, and it just added to this kind of sense of dread that's kind of pervading the episode, you know. And she had another line about memory isn't erased, it's suppressed, and it just felt like a classic kind of X-Files line to me, you know.
Yeah, I mean, memory being suppressed is something that's happened in the X-Files repeatedly, hasn't it? If you think about Mulder's memories of his sister and Scully's memories of her abduction, and memories of all the other people who've been abducted, all the other abductees in the series and stuff. So memory is definitely something that is like a running theme. So the idea, actually, that your memories could be somehow uploaded into some sort of digital format is a really interesting idea. What really interested me in the whole episode was this virtual world, which, you know, when Langley describes it to Mulder and Scully in the bar, and when he's on the phone, he describes, and I love that as well, how they zoomed out kind of from how they left the screen of the phone, and they kind of the next shot was sort of a digital kind of almost 3D version of Langley in a black space, in an empty space, and the next shot is Mulder and Scully sitting at a table in this black empty space. I thought that was really creepy and really effective. This is the weird other world, you know, the ether, where everybody is kind of stuck in a matrix like universe.
Yeah, well, I thought, you know, that scene where you see Mulder and Scully and the backdrop is black, I was wondering, is this just like an expressionistic flourish, or are we supposed to be reading more into this? What exactly is going on here is what I was thinking, you know. But yeah, I agree with what you said about where we see Langley, like the avatar of Langley, and, you know, his description of the simulation and like how it's like he designed heaven or whatever. I thought it was very touching, really. But then all of a sudden it does this about turn where he says, like, I can't remember what he says, like, destroy, it needs to be destroyed or whatever. It was just so well played, wasn't it? And it's like really fascinating on a conceptual basis. It felt like it was covering new ground. At the same time, though, this was in like the lineage of stuff we've seen before, like Ghost in the Machine or Kill Switch, even stuff like First Person Shooter, you know. So it was kind of old and new at the same time.
Or even in when Mulder's undergoing, I think it's the sixth extinction, when Mulder's undergoing brain surgery, you know, it's this idea of like, it's a paradise, but a paradise is still a prison if you're not free. You know, it can be beautiful, but it's a beautiful prison, you know, and what Langley's stuck in is basically a beautiful jail. So, you know, he's not allowed to have any dreams. There's no choice. There's no diversity. It's just pretty, but it's still not freedom. It's a fake world. And it's kind of a little bit what Mulder went through in The Sixth Extinction, you know, when he was having this daydream. It was, you know, a nice world where he had a wife and children, and Deep Throat was alive and lived next door. You know, his sister was there. But actually, the whole thing's fake. It's fake. And Scully has to come in and tell him. Well, his mental version of Scully has to come in and say, it's all a lie. And that's kind of what Langley's saying to them is, you know, it's a lie. None of this is real. And in a way, almost the harsh reality is better than a fake, beautiful dream. And at the end, they're setting him free. I really felt like when Scully was going into the compute, into the machinery, and she was turning off so it would overheat and it would, you know, shut down. I really felt like she was setting Langley free. Like, he's supposed to be dead. He's not supposed to be stuck in some sort of virtual world. He's supposed to be free.
Yeah, except, of course, they didn't get the backup, which is what you find out at the very end of the episode, which was kind of... that final image I thought was quite chilling. Yeah, and like you mentioned about the kind of... this kind of theme of choice, you know. So that comes up again, because we do get this link then to the new myth arc where... You know, what Langley says something along the line, you know, the new conspirators are using all these brains in the simulation to develop science that will help humanity leave the planet, which is kind of what their stated purpose was in the previous episode. So I thought that was a nice link. And, of course, we get this reappearance then of Barbara Hershey playing Erica Price. And I think she's quite a promising character. I'm not keeping up with the spoilers, so I don't know how many more times we're going to see her, but I hope it's a few. You know, and she's this woman, she's at this senior level in this privatized security contractor. I think there's a tricky balance to strike here going forward, because it may be that her appearances are quite fleeting, but I think the fact is that she's very well cast as well. She's a terrific actress, and I think that helps a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, she's a great actress. It's genius casting, actually. She looks glamorous, she looks very feminine, and she's just incredibly creepy. And she almost reminds me a little bit, like, not her personally, her performance. I just want to emphasize. She reminds me a little bit of, like, sort of reptilian. Do you know what I mean? She's got that, like, she's just got that sort of sly look. Her eyes are kind of narrowed. She seems relaxed, kind of sort of. We see her sitting or standing. She seems quite still, almost like a predator lying in wait. Like, she's got time. She can wait. She's set out her plan. In fact, I find her a hell of a lot more scary than I find Cigarette Smoking Man. Don't get me wrong, Cigarette Smoking Man is very threatening. But she also is taking the cue from that as well. He's also like that. I mean, he would stand there in a corner and smoke slowly. You know, it's this sort of like huge, huge villainy. You know, this huge sort of nefarious mind that's thinking up all these different avenues, coming up with this huge plan. But doing it very slowly and calmly. This isn't like violence, quick violence. That's for those sort of weird looking assassins at the beginning. They're the ones that are going to bust in with a gun. Erica Price is going to sit there and just slowly and relaxedly plan the whole thing. But you know, anything she's planning is probably going to end up hurting a lot of people. So I kind of really liked that. I thought she played it really well. I think also it's this idea that the syndicate's way of doing bad things has been updated. So if you think about Herrenvoke, I think it's Herrenvoke, where they go to the farm out in Alberta. I you know, I honestly can't remember, but it's out in the country, and they see all those clones of Mulder's sister and stuff, and so they're doing biological cloning then, and the clones are being used to do work for the syndicate. And this time it feels a little bit like the clones are digital, and they're still being used to do work. Being used to doing work for the syndicate, but it's all been updated, you know, to the digital and technological world.
Yeah, well, I mean, this idea that they've got all these dead geniuses or, you know, scientific pioneers or whatever, and they're kind of harnessing their brain power for, you know, for their own means is, on one level, it's off the wall, but it's a fascinating idea, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
And I think that scene of Erica, I think what also, like, reinforced her kind of menace is that, you know, I thought it was shot very well, where you had them both facing the camera, and you had these kind of sinuous camera moves towards the person, you know, on each side, towards Mulder and towards Erica, you know. And then she hammers home repeated uses of the word this, you know, the episode's title. So she talks about this life on this earth is about to be crushed. This life will have evolved into that. So, I mean, she argues, kind of, her position is that the simulator is necessary for the continued existence of the species, basically. It kind of makes you wonder how this episode is going to date, you know, because sometimes we go back and look at season one episodes or season two episodes and they're about in vitro fertilization or something. And we think, well, actually, this scientific commentary hasn't perhaps aged very well. It's very much of its time. And I sort of wonder if this one will go the same way. But I mean, it's obviously far too early to say.
Yeah, it's hard to say because in a way it's hard to say because we don't know what's going to happen with our technology as it is, like in the real world. You know, I mean, I think if anybody had told you that you would have a computer on a watch like the Apple Watch, or the iWatch or whatever, and you told us that 20 years ago, we probably would be astounded. I mean, I remember the first computer my father ever brought home when I was very, very little. I was practically a toddler, and it was this huge, huge monitor with this tiny, tiny screen. It was an Apple Mac, and all you could do was basically write on a blue background. You know, you could just type out words. So to think that now I'm recording a podcast using technology that I never would have dreamed about, but from just in my lifetime, which, you know, it's only been about 3 and a bit decades, I won't say how old I am, but do you know what I mean? I mean, so in a way we can't know because we can't know our own future. But I think the idea of her saying it's a very frightening idea, the idea of taking a piece of your mind anytime you make a phone call, you know, that you could just pick up your phone and somewhere somebody could tap in and take something from you. And it's very Black Mirror, actually. It's very much like Black Mirror. And he sort of says, you know, I think he questions her on it, and she says, well, you could just not use your phone.
Yeah, and I think that might be my favourite moment in this episode, because she kind of laughs afterwards as well. And yeah, I mean, smartphone usage is like this recurrent motif through the episode, obviously starting with Langley's message that comes through, and then this idea about, you know, we got to stay off the landline, we got to contact Skinner, so on and so forth. And then, yeah, this idea of uploading a mind for a smartphone, you know, painlessly over a couple of hours or whatever they say. It's terrifying, it really, isn't it? I mean, it made me think twice. I don't know about you. It was a full, like, 10 seconds before I grabbed my phone at the end of the episode. You know what I mean?
I mean, also, another great thing that I want to mention is that the building that they house the software and the hardware and the computer in, Titan Point, is actually really a building. It's a real building in New York, and it's in the middle of New York City. It's 29 floors. It has 3 basement levels, no windows, and it's apparently built to withstand an atomic blast. And it's not lit up at night. So it's quite an interesting building with all the buildings in New York, skyscrapers and everything, that are lit up. This building is completely shrouded in darkness. So it's a bit like a gap on the skyline. And it's where AT&T, which is a very big American telecoms company, is residing. But also it's got a lot of security. There's been rumors of the NSA, you know, they can tap into phone calls and internet data in it. So it was very clever to use this building in this episode. Incredibly clever.
Yeah, and what it reminded me of is it reminded me of a much maligned episode from season one, which is Ghost in the Machine, which a lot of people really don't like. But I think there's like fascinating ideas in that episode, even if they're not executed, you know, fantastically. And it just felt kind of like a reprise of that, but in a way that was much more effective in a certain sense. You know, the fact it ends with this climax where you have to turn off the server kind of recalled Ghost in the Machine, which in itself was kind of a look back at 2001 A Space Odyssey. So just finally, maybe, Clara, have you heard the alternative universe theory that's going around about these new episodes at all?
No.
Right. So the idea is that I think there are sort of different proponents of it putting forward slightly different theories, but it's that perhaps when Scully woke up in My Struggle 3, she ended up in some kind of alternative universe, and people are citing various bits of evidence for this. So Miller and Einstein supposedly didn't recognize Scully in My Struggle 3. They didn't seem to know who she was. I mean, I didn't necessarily see it that way, but that's what some people think. And then we've got the fact that the smoking man, his face is recovered. Jeffrey Spender had recovered a lot since we saw him in William. In this episode, I don't know if you noticed with Langley, there's this picture of the lone gunman in Mulder's house at the beginning, and there's a fourth face on it. Did you see that?
Yeah.
And it's kind of a reference to this kind of internet modern folklore, which I believe has been debunked. It's called This Man, apparently a man that a lot of people have been seeing in their dreams and so on. And I don't know, I think people are scouring these episodes and are finding these breadcrumbs and are wondering if everything is as it seems. I mean, that's quite a big one to drop on you there. My instinct is they wouldn't get that kind of tricksy with the narrative overall, but who knows?
I also think that that's going too far into science fiction territory. We have another show that's on at the moment, Star Trek Discovery, and we actually have gone into an alternate universe. It's like, well, they call it a mirror universe in Star Trek. I think it's going too sci-fi. I think that one of the things that Chris Carter has always tried to do is to kind of keep a certain amount of reality in the show. He's tried to keep the X-Files rooted in our universe, in our world. Obviously, there's some problems with that. Like, say, for instance, how is a cigarette-smoking man still alive after basically taking a missile to the face? I mean, he may never explain that, and maybe we'll just have to assume that was some sort of amazing, a miracle medical science. And there is paranormal stuff that happens. So it is science fiction to a certain extent. There's paranormal stuff that happens. You know, shapeshifters and all sorts of stuff, vampires, you know, etc. But they do try and root it in the reality in today's world. And I think he wouldn't be trying to make so many points about today's world, specifically in this episode as well, with technology and spying and everything, that Glenn Morgan's doing it, but I think Chris Carter as well. If it wasn't rooted in today's world, I don't think it can be an alternate universe. It's a nice idea, I suppose, but in a way, I think that I don't really want it to be an alternate universe.
Yeah, at this stage, I don't subscribe to these theories. I have heard one interesting kind of wrinkle to it, which is some people are saying perhaps William is so powerful that he's exerting some kind of power, you know, some kind of effect, and he's shaping the world around him or something. I don't know. I mean, I'll be looking very closely at episode 3, I think, plus 1, to see exactly if anything aligns with these theories or not. But we shall see.
Just the one last thing I would say is there's a really nice moment in this episode where Langley... That is the lady, female character, says that Langley reaches out to Mulder, like in 7 billion people, she reaches out just to Mulder. He reaches out just to Mulder. And I think that's nice because it links back to Folie à Deux, where Mulder says that Scully was his one in 5 billion.
Yeah. And I really like the moment as well when Mulder says Scully's name and there's this kind of like dawning recognition on Langley's face. I thought that was very nice too.
Yeah.
All right, Clara, so we will be back tomorrow, and I'll see you then. Tomorrow we'll be talking about the man who wrote and directed this episode, Mr. Glenn Morgan. In the meantime, though, you can find us on Twitter at @X_cast or on Facebook at the X-Files Basement, which is the X-Cast podcast fan group. But until next time, listeners, trust no one.